in the matter of Gannett Satellite Information Network versus Township of Neptune. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. Thomas Cafferty of Givens, PC, Satellite Information Network, doing business as the Asbury Park.
Good morning. CJ Griffin of Pashmanstein, Walder Hayden for the following Friends of the Court: ACLU of New Jersey, ACDL of New Jersey, Libertarians for Transparent Government, Latino Leadership Alliance of New Jersey, and New Jersey Foundation for Open Government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jonathan Cohen from the law firm of Plosia Cohen, LLC, on behalf of defendant, respondent, Township of Neptune.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sarah M. Gregory, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Attorney General.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Carucci with the law firm of Sills, Cummins & Gross, on behalf of the Municipal Clerks Association of New Jersey, as amicus.
Good morning, Your Honor. Carl Woodward, on behalf of, from the firm of law of Corella Byrne in Roseland, New Jersey. Your Honor, on behalf of the New Jersey State League of Municipalities, the New Jersey Institute of Local Government Attorneys, and the New Jersey School Boards Association, as a meeting.
Good morning, Your Honors. Vito Gagliardi from the law firm of Porzio, Broberg & Newman, on behalf of Amicus, New Jersey State Association of Chiefs of Police.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Woodward, I had you going before Mr. Carucci, and did you have a different plan in mind?
No, that's correct.
Perfectly fine.
I didn't know he was supposed to say
perfectly
that.
Fine. Not to worry. Justice Solomon may participate in this matter by watching the video, and I'm going to invite counsel, as we do typically with so many attorneys helping us today, to try to adapt arguments of those who've preceded you to the extent that you can. Mr. Cafferty, please.
Yes, again, good morning. May please the court. The right of access to government records without the ability to enforce that right is indeed nothing more than a hollow right. Realistically, civil enforcement through access suits is the only effective enforcement for access in this state. Attorney fees are critical to enforcement. As the appellate division noted in the Hunterdon County prosecutor's case, without the award of attorney fees, the requesters can be waging a quixotic battle against a defendant with inexhaustible resources. This quixotic battle, and that case arose out of Oprah, but that quixotic battle is no less present in a common law access case. And those fees in a common law access case, when properly viewed, and contrary to the way the respondent and amici supporting respondent view them, are not penalties. Again, they are a means of enforcement imposed upon the custodian for improperly denying access. There is no apparent reason, theoretical or otherwise, to treat the award of fees differently between a Oprah matter and a common law access matter. This is so for several reasons.
Respectfully, Oprah provides for fees by statute.
That is correct, Your Honor. And respectfully, this court has the authority through any multiple means, as we've argued in the briefs, to equalize that playing field and to require the award of fees as part of a common law access case.
And I understand, you know, the important considerations that you're talking about that are behind an Oprah case,
right?
And usually there's a common law claim with, but there's litigation all throughout our court system in our civil cases, in which important rights are being sought to be vindicated or defended, whatever the case may be, and you're saying here, abandon the American rule for a particular group of claims, really generally that appears the second claim in a two-part complaint in most cases. Why is this distinct from all of the other causes of action out there as to which this court's been consistently refusing fee awards?
Sure. I think, first of all, it is the importance that this court and this state has placed on access to government records and transparency. And there are two means to access those records, and those means essentially proceed both substantively and procedurally along the same basis, except for the issue of fees. And each of those means are co-equal means to the overarching goal of transparency and access. Procedurally, we look, and this court has held in Mason, that there's the same statute of limitations, 45 days, to initiate a challenge to a denial of access. Often there is...
I'm sorry, maybe I just to be clear, my question is not how a common law claim relates to an OCRA claim as to which the legislature has chosen to provide for fees, but why is a common law access to governmental records case so inherently different from, and I'm leaving aside all the statutes that exist that provide for fees, but that would essentially abrogate the ordinary rule that in common law, everyone pays their own fees?
Well, one difference, in many of those other cases where there are important rights at stake, the enforcement mechanism is the ability to recover damages for a violation of that right. There is no such comparable, arguably comparable right in the context of access litigation. Yet we put paramount importance to access litigation.
There are many lawsuits which are injunctive. I mean, they're basically seeking, you're such an experienced lawyer, where you're going into chancery and you're seeking an injunction and you're not anticipating fees.
Typically, in those cases, though, you're vindicating, in most instances, a private right that you're seeking injunctive relief in support of or to restrain violation of. Here, the right that is being sought is not only an interest of the particular requester, but also a public interest in transparency in access to government records.
Respectfully, the Crow versus DeGioia standard often involves public interest. And so what I'm saying here is that it's very difficult to see your claim in this case as something other than abandon or its ultimate result. I understand you're here for the Asbury Park Press, but abandon the American rule in cases in which there are important policy considerations. And I don't think that's where this court's ever gone. And the distinctions, if you say the public's not at interest, often the public has a strong interest in the outcome of purely civil litigation in which either damages or injunctive relief is fought. Well, so what I'm saying is, where's the sharp line that would circumscribe your claim?
Well, let me try to articulate it in this fashion. In the absence of the ability to recover fees on a common law claim, I suggest, as I said at the outset, that right winds up to be a hollow right. It just simply isn't going to be enforced because the enforcement of that right exists through the ability, I suggest, ultimately, for private attorneys general, as private litigants, to mount, as in this case, a five-year battle to secure records, and a battle that resulted in significant societal change. I mean, we had a judgment in this case in 2018 for access to internal affairs records 2 years before, in this case, the Attorney General released portions of those records, and many years before this court decided Rivera. So if you can't have the prospect of recovering attorney fees, I suggest that it is a right without a substance. And if one needs any evidence of that...
So to the extent that we don't award attorney's fees in common law cases, are we making the remedy meaningless?
I think effectively that is the case in most instances.
So then you must be arguing for an abandonment of the American rule.
Well, this court in Mason, I suggest, already, in its language in Mason, suggested, absent a theoretical difference.
Well, respectfully.
Can I raise an issue about Mason so that others won't hesitate to?
Sure.
I understand how the two sentences have generated a fair amount of discussion. It looks to me as though the author of Mason didn't put a lot of analysis there. Is it your position that Mason effectively decided the issue or teed it up for further analysis in a case such as this?
Well, whether, and this is an argument we had at the trial level, whether the language in Mason was dictum or something more when it comes from the Supreme Court is, and there are cases, obviously, as this court knows, that indicates it's very rarely dictum.
Whether it's dictum or not, is it your position that it decided the case, this issue in front of us today?
We argued that before the trial court, but I recognize that courts have reached divergent views on that issue, Your Honor.
I would respectfully suggest, similar to the cert grant order in this case, that we look beyond the short paragraph
right.
And miss.
And that's why we did that in this case. As I said, I think if one needs any evidence that the absence of the ability to recover attorney fees renders the right of access under the common law a hollow right, one only needs to look to the survey that was part of the League of Municipalities submission to this court. Now, that wasn't a survey that was introduced in evidence at the trial court, didn't have the opportunity for cross-examination. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that it's accurate. And what does it say? Well, the common law right of access was first decided in this state in the Ferry Williams case in 1879. So since 1879, the common law right of access has existed. And that survey says, well, 97% of the municipal clerks we surveyed are unfamiliar with the common law right of access. 50% said they haven't received any training on it. And I suggest to you, what that tells us, and the fair inference of that is so because the perception is, well, if I get it wrong in the balancing, so what? There are no consequences. I'm not going to have to pay attorney fees.
Couldn't it simply be that Oprah is an extremely efficient and strong mechanism to resolve these issues very quickly?
I don't think so, Justice, and for several reasons. Number one, in a case I litigated before this court in 1995, Home News versus Department of Health, for the first time this court held that, look, even though there is something that is exempt by a regulation, in that case under the old right to know law, that's not dispositive of the common law. And the court reiterated that in Rivera. I think that's a recognition that the common law plays an important, extremely.
I'm not in any way contesting that. We've obviously recently in Rivera ruled on an important decision on the common law. But the issue, in terms of taking a survey of municipal clerks, it just seems to me there may be other explanations for why that survey came out the way it did, including the fact that Oprah may just simply dominate the landscape, given the teeth that Oprah has.
Well, it just seems to me, I don't think that potential explanation that maybe most cases are decided pursuant to Oprah explains it. I think if you're receiving training under Oprah, assuming that's occurring, and it is implicit, I guess, in the survey, but not explicit, why wouldn't you also receive training equally under the common law?
I have no idea.
Right.
But I'm just wondering about the relevance of it.
Well, I just think...
Couldn't it also be because whereas Oprah sets up a process that is supposed to be quick and have very specific guidelines, the common law multi-factor. There are six non-exclusive Loigman factors, and Loigman, and I might be mispronouncing that, five additional factors now set forth by Rivera. It's not an inquiry where you're just checking a few ministerial boxes. It is a very elaborate balancing test that perhaps municipal clerks are just not able to perform.
My answer to that question is, I disagree with that proposition, and some of the amici have advanced that proposition with respect to OPRA when you examine OPRA, because there are equally complex decisions that a custodian must make under OPRA. We detail them in our brief, but just a couple of them. For example, a custodian must determine under OPRA whether a citizen's reasonable expectation of privacy outweighs any interest in access to a record under OPRA that's otherwise accessible. A custodian must determine under OPRA whether the record is exempt from access by any other statute, rule, regulation, executive order. A custodian under OPRA must determine, in the case of an investigation in progress, whether the release of the record is inimical to the public interest. A custodian under OPRA must determine whether a document is advisory, consultative, or deliberative, and therefore exempt. And I could go on. There are a host, what I'm suggesting, of equally complex problems that have to be handled by a custodian under OPRA. And again, I suggest that the one inference from the lack of training, if the survey is accurate, is because there are little circumstances that a custodian has to fear. If they get that decision wrong, there's going to be any award of council fees. There is no effective mechanism under the common law.
May I suggest, Mr. Cafferty, that the exercise by the municipal clerk, though, is distinctively more challenging in the common law versus OPRA, because one of the aspects of the test involves a balancing of the interests of the requester and their need for the material versus all those other things that Justice Wainwright was identifying. And that exquisite balancing is commonly within the zone that judges are best equipped ultimately to decide. So if you accept just for the moment my premise, just for the sake of argument, that it's a more complicated exercise, I'm wondering if there's a distinction possibly between the award of appellate fees after a judge has done that exquisite balancing and the agency continues to persist in fighting the requester's claim, where that has now been determined by a judge and yet we're now at the next level going on appeal, where there would be consequences and a reward, potentially, at the end of that process. I'm just throwing this out as a concept. If the court decided by court rule under 2:11 or 442-9 to think of appellate fees a little differently, wouldn't that potentially address the fact that without a judge's balancing having occurred yet, it may be asking too much of municipal clerks to make a confident decision about how all them weigh in the end? A very long question, but I think you're gathering the drift of my concern.
And I assume in that hypothetical that in the first instance, in that hypothetical, the decision would still be made by the clerk and then the trial judge.
Yeah.
A couple of concerns I would have with that. And that's based on my practical experience. Much of the time in that kind of situation is going to be spent at the trial level. And the reality is, much of the fees. I had a case against, and it's in the record, so I can talk to it, against the borough of Raritan, where we had over $600,000 in fees. Vast bulk of it seeking access to electronic records of payroll.
This is OPRA.
Yes, and the common law, and the court.
Your award was under OPRA.
Yes, $600,000 in fees because the town made every conceivable argument at the trial level that you could imagine. And one of my favorite lines we ever used in the brief when the complaint about our fees was made was like the arsonist complaining that the fire department used too much water to put out the fire, it said. And the argument that, and the response is that that's where the vast majority of time I suggest is spent.
Should a defendant be entitled to fees when a claim is found to be non-meritorious under the common law? If you're arguing that the prevailing party gets fees, you know, I'm sure you win 99% of the time, if not 100, but not all these claims are found to be meritorious under the common law.
Well, again, I think if you, because I don't view, and I think the courts haven't viewed, the issue of fees as a penalty, as opposed to a mechanism to equal the playing field and incentivize these suits.
But the fees are very specific to the plaintiff under OPRA. It's statutory.
Yes.
And that's why the concept, that's why the court views it that way, because we're following what the legislature said.
But those fees, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, but if we get into the common law, it's prevailing party.
But those fees under OPRA, and OPRA uses prevailing party too, those fees under OPRA. And OPRA carefully distinguishes between fees as an enforcement mechanism and fees and penalties. In 47.1A.11, it talks about penalties, and it has a different standard for penalties. It doesn't say if the clerk prevails, or if the requester prevails, there's a penalty. No. It says it's got to be a knowing and willful violation.
But I think what you're illustrating here, explaining what OPRA does and how specific it is and what the legislature balanced the competing rights and created a statutory right, is that when you say, I want the same fees, I want the same award of fees mechanism or something similar in the common law, then you're in the world of common law award of fees, which it may not be always the plaintiff who is going to get that award.
And there is a mechanism in a situation in a common law case, two mechanisms, where an action is frivolous, as the court knows. I mean, there's nothing that precludes a custodian who deems the litigation frivolous from moving under Rule 1:4-8 or the statute.
That's again a statute with a very high standard. What you're asking for here, and I'm going back to my original line of questions, is abrogate the American rule for one claim in one category of cases. And I'm suggesting to you that is a big can of worms that may have impacts on many, many things that will not only assist plaintiffs.
But this court has abrogated the American rule in different circumstances in its decisions, which it has the authority to amend 442.9 through judicial decisions. And I suggest to you the enforcement, the ability to have a meaningful common law right of access requires the award of counsel fees.
So you began your argument by saying it would be a hollow right without the award
right.
of fees. Many of the cases that we see have an OPRA request and a parallel common law right of access request that is typically not as fulsome. They piggyback one off the other. I know there are certain areas, of course, where Rivera points that as one example, where only the common law would be available. In your experience over the years, how often are these matters brought solely under the common law?
Under the common law, not solely under the common law, putting aside Rivera, we typically will make the request, as we did in this case, under both OPRA and the common law. And I believe we gave a fulsome argument in our initial letter to the custodian of why we thought it was accessible under the common law. But here's the importance, I think, of the common law.
Can I follow up on that? Can you cite a situation where potentially records are available under both and you know, distinguishing Rivera, where a experienced lawyer in this area would just make it a common law claim? Just having reviewed many, many of these complaints, they seem to be count one and count two.
I think, well, let's take the Home News case, right? That dealt with a death certificate, and was originally in the Timmy Wiltsy case that this court just decided a while ago on the conviction of the mother. But that was an attempt to get his death certificate in that case, which would have been precluded because of a regulation of the Department of Health under the AIDS Confidentiality Act that precluded access to cause of death except to a next of kin. So that's a case where it was only accessible ultimately under the common law. But
is there any pre-Mason history of attorney's fees being awarded in common law claims?
In New Jersey?
Yes.
Not that I am aware of, from my experience. But one point I'm sorry, Justice.
Go ahead, you can make your point.
One point I wanted to make is on this whole issue of, well, why, if you can get it under Oprah, would you bring it under the common law? I think any prudent counsel makes the request under both, unless it's a Rivera situation, number one. And there's even right, some...
Any prudent lawyer.
Yeah. And there's even some language in, I think it's the Shea case, an appellate division case, which counsels trial judges don't reach the common law claim if you decide it under Oprah. Whether that ultimately makes sense, should the grant under Oprah be later reversed and then you have a remand because you didn't address the common law. But here's the reality, I think.
But you, sorry.
Most common law cases that are litigated are cases of first impression where it isn't accessible under Oprah. And that's why the argument of the custodians that, well, if you're going to award fees, we should have a good faith exception, in effect, makes the right to recover fees a hollow right.
But if you said that there's no pre-Mason history of attorney's fees being awarded under the common law right of access in New Jersey, then are you saying that for many, many years it was a hollow right and you are asking us to now not make it a hollow right?
I think for many years, both it and to be honest with you, the statutory right was a hollow right because the old right to know law put a cap on attorney fees of $500.
That ship has really sailed.
Yes.
All the way across the ocean.
But and there were.
Yeah, 600,000.
And I think that the answer to your question, unfortunately, is I think there were many fights and battles not fought because of the prospect of what it would cost to fight that fight or battle. And, you know, one of the decisions that the appellate division, or one of the conditions on the grant of fees that the appellate division imposed here, without any basis in the record, parenthetically, was that, well, Gannett can afford to pay, so they shouldn't be able to recover fees.
Mr. Cafferty, I'm not asking about your cases and your filings, which we've seen and we know are first rate. How much detail, generally speaking, in your experience, is being provided to the clerk with respect to the second common law prong about the interest in the subject matter?
I would hope, and I don't stand here and tell you that I've seen extensive documents that other attorneys have filed, but I think there. I understand the concern of the court. If minimal bare bones assertion of an interest is provided in access that outweighs any interest in confidentiality, and then you litigate. My own view is at that point, you can't add additional reasons in the trial court to that basis for access.
Be frozen with the initial request.
I think so. I think candidly, that has to be the situation, or alternatively, if there are additional facts that come to light, you make a new request. I think there is an obligation on a requester to provide as much information to the custodian as the requester may do so, as to why its interest in access outweighs any interest in confidentiality. And that includes, candidly, also the custodian not closing his or her eyes to facts that may be in the possession of the municipality or other public entity, to make a diligent inquiry of, and the custodian's under the same restriction.
So, counsel, a few minutes ago, you noted that most of the common law cases that end up in litigation are cases of first impression. So I think that takes us back to the earlier discussion with regard to the complexity of making these determinations under the common law and the the balancing that has to happen, and the fact that that balancing is left to the trial court. I mean, again, I know you did not agree with that argument, but, you know, you just noted a lot of these cases are cases of first impression. Aren't the common law matters far more complex than what needs to be done under OPRA?
As I say, I don't think so. Don't want to go through, unless the court wants me to, all of the complex decisions that a custodian must make under OPRA. But there are innumerable difficult decisions that the is a record a criminal investigatory record? Well, the way that's defined in OPRA is it's a record not required by law to be made, maintained, or kept on file by the custodian. And that awkward definition, of course, it was the product of a legislative compromise we reached with the Attorney General's office, not to change the definition of a criminal investigatory record from what it existed under the old right to know law. So now you've got to determine and make those determinations. So it is not, I suggest, a simple process under OPRA.
But do any of this, coming back a bit to what I asked you about before, do any of the OPRA factors a clerk must examine involve balancing the strength of the requester's need against other things? I understand there are complexities within OPRA, and every day where new issues are arising under OPRA and interpreting what is a government record. I understand all that. But in terms of a balancing process, which seems to me a very judicial-like exercise, is there anything comparable in OPRA that a clerk is to undertake?
Well, to me, for example, right off the top of my head, the section that, with respect to investigations in progress, is the release of the information inimical to the public interest. To me, that phraseology connotes balancing. What is the public interest? How will it be harmed, as I would interpret the word inimical? How would it be harmed, and to what degree would it be harmed by the release of the information in the investigation in progress? So that's one ready example that comes to my mind.
We can come up with examples, thoughtful examples just like that. But tell me if you disagree. In many, many OPRA cases, it's black and white. The clerk can make that determination right off the bat without too much head scratching. But in the common law cases where you have to have the exquisite balancing, in practice, are we expecting clerks to have to reach out to an attorney and get it right immediately or within a short time frame as this would unfold if we adopt the suggestion that you're presenting?
Well, I think clearly clerks have access to attorneys. I mean, isn't that what the appellate division was talking about when it talked about the quixotic battle against a public entity with inexhaustible resources? I mean, that's in the real world, I think, in the practical world. And I was a municipal attorney for 19 years in one town and two other towns in Middlesex County. I got all kinds of requests for advice under OPRA or the right to know law, which was in effect.
Today, do you believe that clerks making determinations under OPRA, as a matter of course, are going and getting advice from counsel?
If there is any doubt under the specific determination that the clerk has to make, I would think that that is what is occurring.
That's a fair response. Won't there, in almost every common law case, be some level of doubt because of the balancing test?
I think there may be, I think my answer to that is there may be doubt, but it may not be necessarily a legal doubt requiring resort to a counsel. Sometimes there are factual issues that the clerk has to balance. What
sometimes
are
there
the
may
facts?
Be uncertainty as to the factors. I mean, in
right.
Rivera, the court looked critically at the Loigman factors and announced a test that's an enhanced test for a particular category of common law applications.
Right.
So if you if that plays out, even the advice, and it could, of course, occur in a different setting, even the advice of an attorney saying, well, right now under Rivera, this doesn't fit, Loigman, it doesn't fit, the case may go in a different direction.
And so, yes, I think that that's, I would suggest, in all but the most explicit, clear, simple, direct case, the custodian of the record, whether that be a municipal clerk or the designee in another agency, has an obligation to determine facts related to the response and make a diligent inquiry within the organization before he or she makes a determination of accessibility, whether it's under OPRA or whether it's under the common law. And that may, in many of the factors in Loigman and Rivera, involve factual determinations that may require the clerk to talk to the chief of police or somebody in the police department, attorney.
But as been mentioned, it's certainly OPRA laws evolved, but there, I would assume that a municipal clerk has a long list of categories of information that should be produced under OPRA, and another list, shorter, of categories that are exempted, and can resort to a black and white yes or no kind of resource. But the balancing, as Judge Sabatino mentioned,
even with respect to a specific record, and there is a section under OPRA that says ordinarily the time frame is no later than 7 business days, but there's another section, little paid attention to in many instances, that says the following records should ordinarily be made available immediately: contracts, bills. But even within a record that in the four corners of the record is accessible, there may be decisions that have to be made whether information within that record is redactable pursuant to another exemption under OPRA.
And that can be complicated, but I would respectfully suggest it's a lot less complicated than a balancing of two recognized issues that are recognized by the common law that are in competition with one another.
And I don't stand here before this court, and I would never do that, and say it's easy. Balancing is hard. That's true. And decisions under OPRA are hard.
And doesn't that suggest that if you make the wrong, what is ultimately determined by courts to be the wrong call, you don't pay the other side's fees, because it's an exquisite and complicated analysis.
I think that's where we part company respectfully, Justice.
I wasn't expecting a yes from.
and the reason I say that is, I think, again, it depends on how you view the award of attorney fees under the common law and even under OPRA. And do you view those awards as a form of penalty, and is that the lens that you look at them? Or do you view them as a enforcement mechanism to give substance and meaning to the right of access? And I suggest to you, if the view is that they are an enforcement mechanism and not a penalty, then you reach a different conclusion to the question you asked me, Justice.
But they are they're statutory. So whatever we don't we don't question what they are. They are required by statute, very expressly by the legislature. You're asking us to do something very different. It's not.
I am. We are asking, and we ask the trial court to exercise the authority of a court under any number of theories, whether that theory be the authority to amend 442.9 through judicial decisions, or whether the perspective be that this is a form of private attorney general enforcing a public right, or that this is a fund in court. And as we argue in our brief, the fund in court doesn't necessarily have to involve a monetary fund if there are public rights at stake and the individual is vindicating those public rights. That can be a fund in court. Any of those theories, we are unquestionably asking the court to give substance to the right of access under the common law through the only viable enforcement mechanism that exists, and that is the award of attorney fees.
Maybe a good point to break, unless there are more questions.
I have one, and you can think about it over the break if you don't.
not our break. I want to get to one more.
Just very quickly, we do have a sense of forecasting the fiscal consequences on taxpayers if common law claims could justify fee shifting, where the Oprah claim would fail. How often does it happen? What is your sense of that, if any?
I don't obviously have any history that I can relate to your or analytical data, except to say I wouldn't expect it be much different than under Oprah, because I at least have argued, and I believe, that many instances there are difficult and hard decisions under Oprah that custodians make. But
$25,000 under Oprah, and your Raritan case is on the high end?
Yes. it was indeed unfortunate, but the line I related to you is an example of what the appellate division was saying about inexhaustible resources. That wouldn't happen, in my mind, in today's climate for newspapers and what have you. And the newspaper paid. Initially, it had no guarantee it was going to win that case, and it paid that cost. And it paid the cost because of the social benefit that it saw.
Sorry, we have enough on that case for the moment.
Okay.
Sorry. I brought it up.
I had one, I think, very quick question. I thought I saw in the briefs that you were arguing that the information redacted from the records released by the AG's office went beyond the limited material that the trial court had permitted to be redacted. So have the full records that the trial court ordered to be released now been released, or have they still never been released?
It's not been released because when the trial court on August 1, 2018 ordered access to the records, the municipality made an application to stay that pending the appellate process, which the trial court granted. So that stay remains in effect. But very briefly on the issue of the catalyst theory or whatever, we have a judgment 2 years before any records were released from the trial court authorizing the release of the records. So I think in many ways we don't even get to the catalyst theory in this case because we have a judgment.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We heard from C.J. Griffin before taking a break.
Good morning. May it please the court. I want to start by a quote from this court because I think it guides the request in this case. This court has said that one of the common law's great virtues is that it's dynamic, adaptable, and can evolve to accommodate changes in society, and that the evolution of case law must reflect the simultaneous evolution of societal values and public policy. And that's the only time I'm going to be reading heavily from my notes because I want to address questions and talk about what this case means. Yes, we are asking the court to modify the American rule. The legislature and this court has modified it many times before when an important public policy or public interest was at stake. A year ago today, I stood here and argued the importance of access to police internal affairs records. That was a very high-stakes case. Today's case is just as high stakes because without fee shifting, it means we cannot litigate cases under Revere to gain access under the common law. And I think it's important for the court to know where we use the common law the most, and almost always where the common law comes into play, and that's law enforcement records. And the reason for that is under the right to know law, the only records that were required to be made, maintained, or kept on file were subject to public access under the right to know law. And then you, if it didn't fall in that category, you had to use the common law, and there aren't that many common law cases because many battles weren't waged. But when the legislature enacted OPRA, it expanded the universe of records and provided great transparency, except in one area. It maintained that required by law made to be maintained and kept on file language in the criminal investigatory records exemption. And sadly, because so many records fall under that exemption, most police records are exempt under that or other provisions of law. And so we have used the common law the most when it pertains to police records, specifically when it pertains to police misconduct, police conduct, and that's where this court has repeatedly modified the common law to provide access to more and more police records above and beyond what the legislature or the attorney general had provided.
Now you've said that the legislature has abrogated the American rule. Well, it can and does, but you also said this court has on many occasions abrogated the American rule.
Well,
and I know you're an advocate, but I'm looking at 442.9, and if my number is right, I think it's, you know, it's a handful. You can pretty much count it on one hand, and they're very specific. There are really not very many litigation settings. They really argue, other than family law, there really are none. So what I'm suggesting is that this court and the court rule have been extraordinarily selective about very narrow. I don't want to probate. I don't want to particularly say there's nothing to it, but there's nothing analogous in 449 to the kind of nuanced determination that would have to be done in a common law case. It's just not there.
Well, I would suggest two things. I disagree with Mr. Caverty that in the past, most common law cases have been issues of first impression.
Before you get to what I'm trying to suggest is, are you correct in saying that many times this court has tossed out the American rule? Because what when you read 449 and 442.9 and you read the cases behind that, there's just nothing remotely analogous to litigation that would open the floodgates to awards of fees as a routine matter to the prevailing party in litigated settings.
Well, I would say a couple of things. First, I misspoke if I said the court has modified the court rule many times.
No, the American rule.
Or the American rule. I think collectively the legislature and the court have modified it many times. The
legislature's done it, I wouldn't say many times, but specific situations and statutes, consumer fraud, others as well.
Yeah, I think there are a couple dozen statutes that provide fee shifting.
But under the common law, there doesn't seem to be any setting in which the court has recognized a right to a fee award that has anything to do with the world in which you practice, Mr. Caverty practices, and your counsel on the other side practice.
Well, I think that's fair to say, and that's why we are here today. But I think the public policy of the state and the evolving societal values around especially police transparency warrant this court to modify the American rule, because without it, this court's opinions will have little effect. And I think if you look at the evolution of how the common laws come into play, you have Lyndhurst and PAF versus Ocean County Prosecutor's Office were sort of this first time that the court use the common law to say that even when a record is exempt under OPRA, that it can still be accessed under the common law, and that was dash cam videos, and specifically dash cam videos of police uses of force, police deadly force. The court talked about the important public policy of building trust with the public, holding officers accountable, and those sort of things. And from there, the public policy around transparency has rapidly evolved, and around accountability, both with regard to decisions by this court, but also with regard to the Attorney General's policies, with regard to public sentiment demanding more and more. And so as a result of the Lyndhurst decision, for example, I think two things happened. One, it created a fund of information that the Star Ledger used to create this use of force database that compiled 75,000 use of force reports that gave the public such tremendous information, such as the fact that some agencies used force so much more than other agencies, that there were significant racial disparities. And with that, the Attorney General then changed his policy, conceded that there hadn't been the level of oversight, and then published a database that the public can use in real time to review use of force information. The trial court, I think, was influenced by the court's Lyndhurst decision and the importance of police transparency that was expressed in it. And in reliance upon Mason, the language in Mason, and we don't need to go into detail the significance of it, but the court and plaintiffs, like my clients, have relied upon it, granted access to these records for the first time that I'm aware of police internal affairs over the objection of the local police department and the county prosecutors.
So, counsel, I'm not in any way minimizing your argument today, but everything you just described took place without attorney's fees being available under the common law.
Well, I would argue that's not entirely true because of the language in Mason. So let's talk about Rivera. Rivera was a risky case because I think there was a pretty good chance I might not prevail given the Attorney General's directive. But the reason why I felt comfortable taking it was because of the court's language in Mason, and specifically because I saw that another trial court was willing to apply that language from Mason, whether you call it dicta or opening the door to a future discussion. Another trial court felt bound, and there was case law cited by Mr. Cafferty that they were bound to apply it. And so I saw that as an opportunity that the Rivera case needed to happen. We needed access to these internal affairs reports. And I felt confident that I could fight hard and that if I won, I could also convince the trial court in my case that the language in Mesa was also binding on them and then leverage that to obtain a settlement. Unfortunately, the decision was reversed and so it never became about fees. But ultimately, when I won Rivera, there was leverage from the Mason case and then from the affirmation of the right to fees and the ability to have discretion, that leverage did create a settlement. And so it wasn't...
Look, in terms of what you're suggesting here, I can't comment on what judges viewed Mason as, but Mason didn't decide the issue. It just did not. Mason expressly talked about the fact that the issue wasn't before the court. So I view you, as you know, as a superb advocate, and I think you could leverage things probably more effectively than most lawyers in our state, but the suggestion that there's reliance on Mason that has changed the playing field, I would suggest if there's reliance on Mason, then there will be reliance on every time we say we don't decide this issue, we don't decide that issue. The case did not raise that issue.
Well, the trial court in this case and the appellate division viewed it as dicta that was binding upon them, and so that was a path. But I will say,
courts have awarded fees in common law right of access cases, if any.
So post Rivera, we now have
none pre Rivera.
Well, I wasn't litigating cases pre Rivera, so there's many great cases that came before me, and it was only after this. That I became sort of aware of, like, wow, we could rely upon this language in Mason. Another trial court has done it, that I was really willing to litigate Rivera.
Post-Mason, pre-Rivera, how many trial courts awarded fees?
I think there were two or three that Mr. Cafferty cited in his brief, but I would rely upon him to perhaps address that in rebuttal. To me, I didn't bring the cases. So all I can say is that in North Jersey Media Group versus Township of Lyndhurst, where we prevailed under to gain access to many records under OPRA and then also had the common law right for dash cams, the trial court didn't discount the fact that some of that access was under the common law, is my recollection.
And you got your fees were under OPRA.
OPRA, right. And that's often how we've had to litigate common law issues in the past. Again, my experience is that it's rare that you've had to include common law claims, except in the world of policing. But what we would do is if someone came to us and there was all the records were exempt except one under the common law, we said, sorry, unless we can't help you unless you can pay. And they say, we don't have any money to pay. And so we don't litigate them. And so when we could say, well, here's a record they denied under OPRA, we will also add that count to get the extra record under the common law. Then we were able to bring the suit, and the trial court generally would give us our fees, recognizing that maybe they would discount them a tiny bit for the common law portion, but not always.
How frequently post-Rivera have you found where you've successfully persuaded a trial judge doing the balancing that you're entitled to the documents and the judge orders disclosure, do you find that the other side takes an appeal? Is that the frequent response when you, if that the trial judge does the balance, you win common law claim, and you're facing now, oh, another round of having that one appeal. Is that the customary or frequent response, or is it not that clear what the pattern is?
So I would say it's not clear, and the reason for that is that Rivera was only issued in March, recognizing that, you know, this court was considering granting cert, the petition had been pending for a long time. We did file some immediate requests a couple days after Rivera and explained why we thought the Rivera balancing factors required disclosure. We were very careful to pick cases where Rivera, we thought, clearly applied. Major discipline, names in a major discipline report for sustained complaints of excessive force and there was a suspension and that sort of thing. Some agencies complied, but I have very carefully selected cases to file since then. I think I've filed 6, 2 for newspapers, 4 for Mr. Rivera. One of them is pending in the sense that I filed it in May and it's not even gotten to the order to show to the hearing yet. And I think I won't go on to it here, but in the last point of my brief, I talk about the procedural flaws with common law cases and how they're not moving because of it. Three of them have been fully resolved where the trial court ordered disclosure of the records.
And no appeal?
No appeal except one, which is my appeal. So in 2 of those cases, the trial court ordered disclosure and also awarded attorney's fees. Judge Mizdahl in one of them, Bergen County, ordered fees without any real analysis of...
And were there OPRA claims in those cases?
No. So in Rivera case, she strictly can bring common law claims. In another judge in Atlantic County awarded fees. He went so far as there to say that even applying this good faith language in Gannett, that he didn't feel that agency acted in good faith. They didn't engage in balancing. They made a lot of ridiculous arguments in opposition. And then there's 2 other cases that are pending where the trial courts have ordered the agencies to redact the records, and they haven't made a decision on fees.
I want to come back to the discrete issue in front of the court, and mindful of the time, you have about 5 more minutes to present additional arguments.
So all of that is to say, because of Gannett is a published decision that says trial courts have discretion to award fees. Because of that, I felt confident bringing these cases. And the way it works is a threat of a common law fee causes enforcement. So once I obtained the order from Judge Mizdahl that said, I'm going to release records and give you fees, when an agency has denied access in Bergen County, I sent them Judge Mizdahl's decision and said, I don't think that the outcome would be any different in this case, and she would award fees, and we got a risk outcome.
I'm encouraging you to speak more generally about the principles and not how individual cases have been handled.
Okay. It's difficult because it is that practical experience that's let me know that the fee shifting mechanism is why agencies comply, and that without it, agencies won't comply. So, for example, in that Mercer County case where the court didn't award fees and I'm appealing, I haven't found Mercer County agencies to be that forthcoming with IA records.
You didn't get it hit with a fee award, I assume.
No.
When you lost.
No, and to be clear,
could a court under your formulation of what you are seeking this court to do, award fees against you, leaving aside frivolous litigation? I know you wouldn't be involved with that, but as a losing party.
No, unless it's a frivolous case, and occasionally
Why?
There are them.
Why?
If because the rule about, that we're asking for.
I know you're asking for a rule that only you know works in the direction of plaintiffs, but that's not how the narrow departures of fee awards of from the American rule work.
Well, they do work that way in all the other public interest cases where the legislature has provided fee shifting. But, and the reason for the distinction.
I'm talking pure common law, counsel. Pure common law. You could be hit with a fee award under the abrogation of the American rule that's being sought here. Could you not?
No, because this court has supervisory powers over the common law.
You're saying this court should say only in one direction.
Yes, exactly, because both of those support the same public policy, and the public policy is enforcement of this court's decisions around transparency, in particular police transparency.
Could this court find that the burden on the taxpayers in a particular case is just so high and so unwarranted and handled in a manner that was not efficient, that the municipality is entitled to fees, because there are policy considerations on the other side whenever there's a fee award.
If it's a frivolous case, then yes, I think it's appropriate. But the fee shifting the opposite way towards the requester would serve as the same discouragement to bring a suit as if there was no fee shifting at all. So if the next Rivera case, we request an internal affairs report. I would be very hesitant to take a case if I knew that if we lost, which is that we would somehow have to pay their fees. I wouldn't do it.
I have no doubt.
And so I guess the ultimate question before the court is, does it want the police transparency decisions to be enforced? If there's not a fee shifting provision, some agencies might produce them. But if there's not, other agencies won't, and we won't be able to sue.
You've not asked for a rule that only applies to police transparency matters. You're asking it for all common law claims.
No, but if the court limited it to police transparency, I think it would essentially do the same thing because, as I said at the beginning, the common law is most often used in the world of something relating to policing. And so if I'm going to walk away from here with nothing or a decision that gives us fees in this world of common law access, or that says, you know, where we've weighed in and there are factors to consider that there could be fee shifting there, that's much better than walking away with nothing. There were a couple of... And so there were a couple of other little comments that I had. Chief, with regard to your question about whether the common law is a backup, whether the common law is ever separately pled, generally no. Like, as I explained before, we always try to have paired it with an OPRA claim so that we could have a right to fees. But post-Rivera, and that's where this decision today will have the most impact, they are just common law cases. There's no OPRA count. And Chief Justice Wiener, after regarding your question about whether pre-Mason it was a hollow the right to access documents under the common law, I think Mr. Cafferty has it right that there were many battles that weren't waged by his clients, by newspapers, by average members of the city. There was not a huge body of law under the common law, Judge Sabatino, in terms of fiscal claims, I want to make it clear that not every OPRA case is $600,000. I've never had one that was $600,000. I maybe should have not been so lucky there.
You get to bill Mr. Cafferty because I think you requested rebuttal on his behalf, which is not how we do it. So you can charge him for that and see what you get.
So in my experience, an average public records case, these ones that we're litigating post-Rivera, OPRA cases are sometimes simpler, so they're maybe $3,000 or $4,000, sometimes more, depending on the agency's response. But the average one so far with the internal affairs reports, because the agencies have fought them so hard, have been somewhere in the $14,000 to $25,000 range. But the way it works is when there's the threat of attorney's fees, the agency is much more likely to give you the record. And so I would say 60 to 70% of the OPRA cases that we file end up resolving where the agency will give us the record sooner. And so that saves the taxpayer dollars on our end, but also on the defense counsel's end.
Questions, anyone?
No.
Thank you, Counselor.